Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Chun with Medical Monday. More than 50 million people worldwide have Alzheimer's disease, the insidious brain condition that robs sufferers of their memories and other cognitive skills, including computation, word finding, and in extreme cases, their self-awareness. Daniel Gibbs of Portland, Oregon is one such person, though he's also a retired neurologist who spent much of his career in the clinical care of patients affected by Alzheimer's. Gibbs's diagnosis occurred because he chose to undergo genetic testing in order to fill in some holes in his family tree. And he found out that he had two copies of the APOE4 gene, which is highly associated with an elevated risk for Alzheimer's. In retrospect, his very gradual loss of his sense of smell was also a tip-off that he had a pathologic brain process going on. In spite of this grim diagnosis, Dr. Gibbs remains remarkably upbeat, and as you'll hear today, he's a zealot for early detection of Alzheimer's and reducing the stigma associated with it. He's participated in numerous clinical trials, and through judicious use of nutrition and exercise, he's slowed down the progression of his condition. Dr. Daniel Gibbs, author of the new memoir, A Tattoo on My Brain, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Daniel Gibbs, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start just by having you tell us how you know that you have early Alzheimer's disease. I mean, what a frightening thing to hear. How was it you learned that you had this?
Well, in retrospect, I think the first symptom that I had of the Alzheimer's was more than 15 years ago when I started to lose my sense of smell. At the time, Alzheimer's wasn't on my radar at all. But about a year after I'd first noticed some decrease in my ability to smell things, I started to have these weird, illusory smells that would pop out of nowhere. They're called phantosmias. And they're not particularly associated with Alzheimer's, but I think they're associated with really anything that can cause a loss of smell. And my take on it is maybe the brain's trying to place a smell there to make up for what it can't smell. That's just my own speculation. But still, for a few years after that, I had no idea that I was going to have Alzheimer's. I thought, you know, gee, maybe I'll get Parkinson's disease, because I was really quite aware as a neurologist that 80% of people with Parkinson's lose their sense of smell, at least partially. But at the time, I really wasn't aware of the association with Alzheimer's. And then in about 2012, I started to have some very mild cognitive problems, and nothing that would be outside of what you would expect in your early 60s, which I was at the time. When I had moved to a new office, I never could learn my new telephone number or my new address, but I didn't have occasion to use either one very often at all, so I didn't really think much about that. I also had a little trouble remembering the names of colleagues at times, but again, I didn't really make much of that. However, about that time, I, by accident, learned my APOE4 status. I learned my wife is amateur genealogist, and she wanted us to check our DNA to fill out some holes in our family trees. And at that time, this would have been, I guess, about 2012, there was an option when you were getting your genes tested for genealogical purposes to find out certain medical risk genes. And there was a locked box for two neurological genes. One was the LRRK2 gene, which is the most common cause of hereditary Parkinson's disease, and the other was APOE, which is it's the most important genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. And I was interested in looking at those because I thought, well, maybe I'm going to get Parkinson's. It'd be interesting to know if I had this LRRK2 gene. And I didn't, but I was shocked to find out that I had two copies of the APOE4 allele, which gave me a much increased chance of getting Alzheimer's disease. So that put it on my radar screen. And the reason it wasn't there up until that time was that both my parents had died early from cancer, so they didn't live long enough to get Alzheimer's. And, of course, each of them had at least one copy of APOE4, since I have two. But digging a little deeper, I did find other family members, you know, a great uncle, probably at least one grandmother, who most likely had it. So then it was on my radar screen, and I retired early because I didn't want to run the risk of getting into trouble making a medical mistake from a memory lapse, even though there's no way clinically that I had Alzheimer's disease at that time. And then in 2015, I was part of a study at University of California, San Francisco, of a new PET scan tracer for tau, and they wanted people who were at risk for Alzheimer's disease. And so during that study, I had both amyloid PET scan, tau PET scan, high-resolution MRI scan, and 2 days of cognitive testing. And at the end of that, I had mild impairment on my cognitive testing, but I had significant abnormalities on both of the PET scans. So I had a diagnosis of, at that time, mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's pathology.
Okay, and so let's unpack that a little bit for our listeners. So you mentioned tau, but then also there are characteristic features of Alzheimer's in the brain, which are these amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. Those are just pathology jargon words, but those are the actual abnormal stuff, abnormal things, bent proteins that kind of accumulate in the brain and sort of gum up the works and make folks afflicted with Alzheimer's, you know, cause you to lose cognitive function, to slow down, especially with memory, for example, with word finding like you've described. And those studies you were part of were clinical studies. So this is not something that, unfortunately, we were only up until, you know, very recently, in order to diagnose Alzheimer's, it was really a diagnosis of almost exclusion, and we had to do neuropsychiatric or neuropsychological testing. But now with these more advanced imaging studies, you can see these pathologic proteins on scans without having to do something as drastic as a brain biopsy. So do you think that'll come into more widespread clinical use, or is it still too expensive?
Well, it's too expensive now. And there are many parts to the question and that I think are important to address. And one is that we've learned, you know, from the research done with these PET scans and also with, pathological specimens and people who have died, that these changes in the brain, particularly the amyloid plaques, get started in the brain up to 20 years before there's any cognitive impairment. So the pathology, the abnormalities in the brain start long before we have anything that we would call Alzheimer's disease. So the amyloid plaques are very early. The neurofibrillary tangles, which have tau in them, show up probably a couple of years before the cognitive impairment, so still a little earlier than noticeable abnormalities in function. So this recognizing that has really opened up a whole new window on Alzheimer's disease as being a much lengthier disease. When I was in training and in the first part of my career, the people I saw with Alzheimer's disease were towards the end stage of their illness, and they were very impaired, and the fact that they had dementia was not in question. And now we're realizing that if you allow a definition based on pathology, in other words, having the amyloid and having the tau, the disease is much, much longer. It's decades long. And why this is important, and I've become kind of a zealot about this, is that I think what we're going to need to do going forward is to shift our emphasis on treating or preventing this disease from the late stages where we've been focused since Dr. Alois Alzheimer discovered it back in 1902 or something like that, to the earlier stages before there's any cognitive impairment, because that's where I think the sweet spot's going to be in terms of lifestyle changes or actually new drugs that are on the horizon. And let me just jump in and also address the PET scan issue. They're really expensive. There's no doubt about that. And there are two approved now, one for amyloid, an amyloid PET scan, and there now is a tau tracer for a tau PET scan. But insurance companies and are not going to be paying for them anytime real soon, nor will Medicare. But I think what's really exciting is that there are now a number of blood tests on the horizon. They're not clinically available yet, but both for amyloid and tau that can be detected in the blood that reflect the amyloid in the brain and the tau in the brain. So we may have within a few years, we may have much less expensive and easy to use biomarkers or tests for Alzheimer's disease that can be used to identify people who are in the earliest stages. At the very least, they'll be at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease later in life.
And then we could
intervene earlier.
Yes, no, that you answered perfectly. Yeah. And Dan Gibbs, I want to clarify a couple other things. You in retrospect, noted that you had phantasmias or this these hallucinatory, if you will, smells, and also that often associated with Parkinson's. And now I think more associated with Alzheimer's is anosmia, or loss of sense of smell. I think many listeners who have been had COVID-19 and have had loss of a sense of smell may be worried to hear that and think, oh, my gosh, I lost my taste and my senses of taste and smell during the pandemic. Does this mean I'm going to get Alzheimer's? And I just would love it if you could reassure our listeners that that is probably not the case.
No, absolutely not. And the mechanisms are thought to be totally different. People who lose their sense of smell and taste from COVID, it seems to be more a problem with receptors in the nose or in the mouth, rather than problems within the brain, which is the problem in Alzheimer's. The other thing is that the loss of smell in Alzheimer's is insidious. It just gradually comes on over many, many years. The loss of smell in COVID is abrupt. People say there's like a switch going off, that all of a sudden they notice they can't smell anymore. And fortunately, for most people with COVID, the sense of smell comes back. It may take some months. With Alzheimer's, it doesn't come back. It goes, it's worse and worse until it's gone. Interestingly, my phantasmias, my hallucinations, were most frequent at when I first started them. They would happen several times a week and gradually became less frequent as the years went by and then stopped altogether a few years ago. So I think whatever part of my brain was producing those illusory odors is probably gone now. It's probably dead.
Huh. Well, one advantage, perhaps advantage to this, you write in the book, is that I guess when there's a smelly job to do around the house, you get elected to do it and it doesn't really bother you too much because you can't smell it anyway.
Not at all, yeah. You know, there's another aspect to it too, you know, that we'll probably want to talk about in a few minutes is diets that are recommended to help reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. The diets tend to share in common the sorts of bitter green vegetables that people like to not like, you know, like kale and you know, spinach and broccoli and Brussels sprouts and things like that. Whereas now, I really quite like those because I can taste them. I pick up that little bitter flavor, whereas most foods to me taste the same. So, you know, it's food is very bland to me now. So I don't have any trouble following these diets that I probably 30 years ago I would not have chosen to have a kale salad, but now I don't have any trouble with it.
Well, let's go there. So you actually do have some, based on the fact that you've participated in a number of clinical trials, you've pointed out that as much as I think 50% of what we know, or maybe I'm phrasing it incorrectly, but how we can help people who have some risk of Alzheimer's could be helped, benefited, or controlled by diet and exercise alone, because we don't have much in the way of medication for it at this point. What kinds of diets, and I guess specifically, what kind of exercise and diet do you follow?
Well, the data is overwhelming for exercise, for aerobic exercise. The only studies that don't show a benefit are those that are done on people with moderate to advanced Alzheimer's disease. You know, by that time, the horses are out of the barn, and that's not the time to start exercising. I mean, the people who exercise at that stage do get some benefit from sense of well-being, but it doesn't help slow the disease at that stage. But exercise that started in midlife can reduce the progression, the rate of progression, or the chance of getting Alzheimer's by up to 50%. And that's, you know, if we had a medication that did that, it would be worth billions of dollars. And, you know, we've got it. It's just you've got to have the motivation to start this in your 40s or 50s and not wait until your 70s. And the people who should be making a point of this are people who have a family history of Alzheimer's, because your risk is going to be higher than somebody with no family history of Alzheimer's. And this is something that really will help. So what I do for exercise is I have a fitness tracker, and I aim for getting at least 10,000 steps a day. That's about, for me, that's about 4 miles. And I live in the hills, and so my dog Jack and I walk every day up in the park behind our, it's a huge huge park, like 8 miles long park, with mountain-like trails. And we get about 300 feet of elevation, and I get my heart rate up to 125. And that's a really good workout. And it's not at all onerous. I enjoy it. I'm not a runner, but running would be great. Aerobic exercise seems to be the key, though. You don't just strength, weight workouts, that sort of thing, you know, may be good for other things, but it's probably is not going to help much for the Alzheimer's prevention.
And you also, you mentioned that you can taste those bitter foods, particularly those green leafy vegetables. Are there other foods you can't taste? And so those, you actually enjoy the taste of those because they provide some taste?
Yeah, that's true. So I like a lot of spices on my food because I essentially eat the same thing for lunch every day just because it doesn't matter. It all pretty much tastes the same. But the diets that have been shown to, again, slow the progression of dementia and make it less likely that one gets it are all cousins of the Mediterranean diet. They're plant-based diets, and you can't go wrong. They're all diets that are healthy diets that anyone is going to tell you is good for your heart, for your blood pressure, for your diabetes, but it's also good for your brain. And the diet that I follow is called the MIND diet, and I can never remember what the acronym stands for. It's a Mediterranean-diet for neurodegeneration or something like that. But it adds a little bit more emphasis on foods that are rich in flavanols, like certain nuts and berries, and the green leafy vegetables, low in the red meats, and low in cheese, which is the hardest part for me because I love cheese. So for some reason, and I had a nutritionist explain it to me, but I can't remember what the answer was now, what's supposed to be bad about the cheese, but the diet limits you to one serving of cheese per week, and I think that's just totally unreasonable. So I cheat on that. But, you know, all these things, all these diets, research that's done on these diets show that you don't have to be perfect on them. You know, people who follow them religiously get the best result, but people who only follow it, you know, half-heartedly still get some benefit. I can't quote those numbers to you because I can't remember them, but, you know, that it's something you can look up. And I don't find it onerous at all. I get to eat a lot of dark chocolate, which I love, and I still get to have my glass of red wine. So that's all good.
There you go. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Dan Gibbs, who is a retired neurologist who also has a PhD in addition to an MD and is author of the new memoir, A Tattoo on My Brain. And it's his story, a neurologist's personal battle against Alzheimer's disease. And Dan Gibbs has early Alzheimer's and has actually written this book in that state and is doing this interview and is a living, breathing beacon of hope because you are participating in clinical trials and have taken it as your mission to take away the stigma of Alzheimer's disease. Let me ask you this, Dan Gibbs. How often do you get tested cognitively to see if you're having a decrement in your cognitive function?
Oh, I usually see my local neurologist every 6 months, and really my scores haven't changed in several years, so you know, I'm holding pretty steady. I score about a 25 on the Montreal Cognitive Assessment Exam, which is a screening test for dementia, and the perfect score is 30, and I score about a 25, so which is still pretty good.
That's good, and you mentioned the exercise. Now, you do some other things to keep your mind supple, and I'm just going to list a couple here. One is you play the piano and have your whole life, and you have some interesting writing in the text about how it's, you know, the music and that automatic memory is sort of a different part of the brain. And so that's kind of one of the last things to go, but that it's important for you to keep those circuits running. But you also are a bird watcher. You mentioned your vigorous walking every day, but you're an avid reader. You do crossword puzzles. You do math computation. Tell us about those activities and what the thinking is on those activities in the treatment or prevention of Alzheimer's.
Well, it does seem to be important to stay mentally active. And the data suggests that the sorts of activities that are best are those that are learning, causing you to learn new things rather than just retrieving old memories. And that's not bad. It's not bad to retrieve old memories. But for example, I do love to play the piano, and I can still play some things that I learned when I was a teenager, usually by memory. But what apparently is better, and I try to do it, is to every time I sit down at the piano, I'll play some of my old favorites, but then I'll try something new. You know, I'll try to play a piece that I've never played before or maybe haven't played in years. And, of course, that's really hard. But then I'll try to work on it and come back to it a few days later and work on it again, just like your mother was telling you to practice the piano, practice and practice. But by learning new things and practicing new things, I think what you're doing is building new circuits in the brain, new synapses that may help. You can't do anything you can't do much anyway to keep the nerve cells from dying off. But the ones that you have left, you want them to be working as efficiently as possible and connecting up and having allowing nerve cells that are left to take over ones that have died. That seems to be the kind of philosophy behind it. You know, people say that doing crossword puzzles are not that helpful because doing crossword puzzles all the time makes you good at doing crossword puzzles. But I enjoy doing crosswords. I do the New York Times puzzle online while I'm having my lunch. And by the end of the week, it's pretty hard. And I usually will learn something new. And so if there's a geographical place I've never heard of or a word I've never heard of that gets filled in, then I'll go look it up and try to, you know, make it a learning moment and develop my brain that way. In the book, I mentioned that I used to, as I was falling asleep at night, do kind of mental arithmetic to try to keep my brain going that way. I find I can't do that anymore, or I can't do it very well because I can't remember the intermediate steps of a multiplication thing, or let alone division, like I could a couple of years ago. So I'm losing that a bit, but I still try, and you know, I can still figure a tip.
Well, I wanted to ask you a sort of a curbside consultative question here, and that is that I see many patients, or especially their family members or their elder parents or loved ones, and if there's a cognitive impairment or perhaps on the dementia spectrum, we get asked all the time about these drugs that are marketed. They're a class of drugs called the cholinesterase inhibitors. And I've always found that they're not particularly helpful. But I mean, I guess for families or patients, they offer some ray of hope that there are these drugs that are FDA approved to at least somewhat slow the progression of Alzheimer's. But they have side effects. They're not particularly pleasant. And I was wondering, I mean, you don't have to name the individual drugs or comment on them, but I guess I was hoping for our listeners you could make a comment on those.
Yeah, no, you know, when I was practicing, you know, I saw a lot of patients with dementia when I was practicing neurology. And when I first started practicing in 1989, there was absolutely nothing that we had to offer. And then in the mid-90s, the first of the cholinesterase inhibitors came out. Actually, the first one was Tacrin, but that caused such a liver damage that people stopped using that pretty quickly. But then Aricept came out, and then a couple of more a few years later. And it was kind of striking because occasionally people would have a pretty remarkable improvement for a couple of years or so. A lot of people had no change at all. And I have to admit, I was a bit of a skeptic about those drugs as a doctor because I thought they were almost kind of like a placebo. I didn't think they did a lot for most people. And you're right, they do have side effects. But I ended up starting one of them myself a few years ago, and I think it made a noticeable improvement. Side effects could be a problem, and I learned something about side effects. The most common one is it gives you diarrhea and you know, cramps when you first start taking it, and you want to start with as low a dose as possible. Just, you know, like half of the smallest. I think the smallest Aricept tablet is 5 milligrams. If you cut it in half and take that for a week or two, and then gradually increase up to get to the 10-milligram dose, which most people stay on. If you go much faster than that, most people will get sick. But the other side effect that I had never heard of was when I first started taking it, I got terrible nightmares. I mean, really, really bad. And I looked it up online, and sure enough, that's a known side effect. But even now, the package insert tells us that we're supposed to dose it at bedtime. And I think that's to minimize the gastrointestinal side effects, the diarrhea and cramping. But if you take it in the morning, the nightmares go away. And so, I mean, I would tell you, Dr. Schumann, if you have patients that you've got on it and are having trouble with nightmares, switch them to morning dosing, and it makes a world of difference. A week or so ago, I got my pills mixed up, which happens even though I've got them in the pill minder, and I took my Aricept in the evening instead of in the morning, and I was awake with people, or felt like I was awake with gunmen trying to kill me all through the night. It was terrifying. Yeah, and the next day I went back to take it in the morning, and I was fine. So they can be very sleep disruptive.
Well, Dr. Gibbs, I wanted to just ask you one last question, which is, it's an accomplishment for anybody to write a book or a memoir. And here you are with early Alzheimer's that seems to be both, pathologically evident, or at least on the imaging studies that you were part of, as we talked about early on in these PET scans as part of a research protocol. You have some cognitive impairment on these neuropsychometric assessments. And then, you have acknowledged that you have some word finding and some facial recognition difficulties, although you just wrote an article for Scientific American Online talking about how with all of us wearing masks throughout the pandemic, it's hard for pretty much anyone to recognize faces, which I think was a really interesting point. But my question to you is, how did you pull it off? How did you write this book? It's really, really a wonderful book. And I think I agree with some of the people who left blurbs on it, that for anyone facing a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or a family member with cognitive impairment, this is a book that people should read to kind of understand what the journey is like.
Yeah, well, I think probably writing the book was the biggest therapeutic boost I've had. The mental activity involved and looking up papers and putting my thoughts together. Now, I have to say, my first attempt at writing it, I had a manuscript after 6 months, and I sent it to an agent who gave it the thumbs down, and I realized I was going to need some professional help. And that's when I latched on to a really excellent co-writer who gave me daily writing assignments. And I was writing this book like I wrote science papers in the past, just the facts, ma'am, like Joe Friday used to say, Sergeant Joe Friday. And that's not very interesting. And Teresa really got she said, well, how did it feel to do such and such? And, that's not something I would have thought of writing about as a scientist. And that made it, with Teresa's help, it made it a much more readable book.
Dr. Daniel Gibbs is a retired neurologist who's author of the new memoir, A Tattoo on My Brain, A Neurologist's Personal Battle Against Alzheimer's Disease. Dr. Daniel Gibbs is author of the new memoir, A Tattoo on My Brain, A Neurologist's Personal Battle Against Alzheimer's Disease. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.